Well, we are here with another 500 albums. And this time we are having, first off, we're talking about some fire albums, which is always a fun thing. But this time our guest is Ethan Simmy. He is from 15 Minutes Marvel and 24 Minutes of A24, which we'll talk about later. Ethan is a solid dude. I have podcasted with him quite a few times and he's awesome. And we're so fortunate to have such an awesome podcast community around us that we had to bring on Ethan, and I'm so glad we were able to.
Sorry, I'm distracted by the bugs clinking into my window.
That's when you chime in and said, yeah.
Yes, sorry. Before we started recording, I was explaining I have these giant bugs that attack my house every night, and it sounds like it's hailing in this room. So if you hear any weird clinking, that is why.
The funds of Virginia.
Yes. I don't know what they are. They're terrifying. I'm scared to go outside at night. It's great. This was a great episode. We never really know what we're going to get into when we do these 500 albums, because every album is so different and each conversation is different, and they never have disappointed yet. We've only done four, but this is one of our best ideas yet. So let us not waste any more time. I'm Leah.
I'm Bethann.
And this is She Will Rock You.
Where are they getting a dub in a CBS executive meeting?
No. Bitch, don't touch my thermostat.
The ghost be like, hold up, before I haunt you, let me turn down the thermostat.
Who is this band?
We're on page one, guys.
This is She Will Rock You.
Welcome to volume four of 500 Greatest Albums. Tonight, we are joined by friend of the pod, Ethan Simmy. Welcome.
What is up? Ethan. Thanks for having me.
To people who may not know you, please tell us about yourself and your many podcasts that you have going on.
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, I just want to say thanks for having me on this pod. I do not have a music background, so I'm hoping to give a little bit of a common person's take on the music. But I'm excited to talk. I have an A24-based podcast called 24 Minutes of A24. And we talk about every movie and show produced by A24. And then I have a Marvel podcast called 15 Minutes of Marvel. And I talk about Marvel. So as you can tell, I'm kind of a movie guy. That's kind of my realm. And that's how I got to know Bethann, actually. I've had her on my show and whatnot. So yeah, that's my jam. But two podcasts, I'm everywhere.
Yeah, and you do the podcast with Ben, our other really good friend at Three Films in a Pod, who we absolutely adore. And then you're friends with Thomas Carter Rochester, who's also a very good friend of the pod. So
I was on his show last night.
Yeah.
I love it. That's so exciting. Leah, were you on there with Jade Ruffalo?
No, I was on Reckless Rebels.
Oh, you're on Reckless Rebels. Okay. Yeah, nice. I've been in the podcast game long enough now, so I know you, Bethann. Now I know you, Leah. And like I'm starting to know Thomas and Ben and all of these people. We kind of have our own little podcast community. It's pretty rad. So, but yeah, this is exciting.
It was inevitable for you to get on the show. Like it was a long time coming. So I'm glad we were able to finally get this up and running.
I'm glad. Yes. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
So tonight we're going to talk about three more from the never-ending Rolling Stone list of 500 greatest albums.
No, it has an ending. It ends at the 500 mark. Sorry.
It is never going to end on this show because we're doing them three at a time, like 3 months apart. So tonight on the docket, we have number 3, Joni Mitchell's Blue, number 16, The Clash, London Calling, and number 17, Kanye West's My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. And that is in list order, so that means I'm first, and I hate being first, so here goes nothing. So Joni Mitchell's Blue, which if you have listened to our podcast, we have a Joni Mitchell episode. Mm-hmm. I did Joni Mitchell, so this is kind of cheating that I did this, but she's been sitting around since the first like draft, so I felt like I needed to knock this one out.
Considering the last, all of them that I've done has been albums I've covered, which is not, we have not changed the pattern at all.
No.
This round. The pattern will not change. You are allowed one, okay? To make up for my laziness.
Okay. I've only done one, not that we haven't covered. But anyway. So, Joni Mitchell's Blue. When she wrote this album, she had just finished or just come off of promoting Ladies of the Canyon in 1970. And she was like, being famous is hard. I'm going to take a year off, which is fair. Mm-hmm. So she takes a year off. She wants to go on vacation, recharge. She was starting to feel super claustrophobic in her art because she couldn't go anywhere. She couldn't move freely. She couldn't get inspiration from the things that she's used to getting inspiration from. And so she just disappears to Crete, which goals. And so most of Blue was written starting at this experience on Crete. So while she's there, she starts hanging out with basically like an artistic community. It's a bunch of weirdos that just make art. And she's introduced to the Appalachian dulcimer, which you hear a lot on this album, just by some dude. And I like, it. I picture it as like a campfire guy. Circle. Yeah. They're just hanging out on the beach and some dude whips out a dulcimer. She met a guy named Carrie Raddatz, who she kind of dated for a little bit. He had fierce looking blue eyes and the mark of Cain on his brow. They started dating. The song Carrie on the album was written for his birthday. They didn't last super long. Pretty much just that's that song.
That's unfortunate that that relationship is now immortalized in song.
Oh, this forever. Is the ultimate breakup album, as you will hear.
That's the song equivalent of getting the tattoo of their name.
Yeah,
it kind of is.
True.
That is one of three breakups on this album.
Oh. Well.
So. So as she's hanging out in Europe and on Crete, she starts to like get all these musical ideas and starts noticing that the songs she's writing all have very similar themes of love, loss, escapism, and a quest for some like unreachable spiritual truth. So it gets a little existential. And even though she's having the time of her life in Europe and she loves the people she's hanging out with, she starts to get homesick because she's in Europe and she's not from Europe. She's from Canada. So she comes back home. But meanwhile, she stops in Paris on the way back, and this is where her homesickness is like really strong. And when she writes California, because she's missing, she lives in Canada. I don't know why she's missing California, but she is. So I get this doesn't really fit chronologically, but some of the breakup songs on Blue were inspired by her relationship with Graham Nash. Before she left for Europe, the relationship was already like on the rocks. They were not going to last much longer. And when she got to Europe, she just sent him a telegram and was like, yeah, we're broken up. Okay, thanks, bye.
Nice.
Wow. That's cold. Classy. That's cold. That's tough.
Yeah. But it needed to happen. And while she was in that artist retreat in Europe, she wrote My Old Man and River about that relationship and about how she's feeling about the relationship. She finally returns to Canada in late July. While she's there, she plays at the Mariposa Folk Festival alongside James Taylor, who is important to this story very shortly. They had met a year earlier at the Newport Folk Festival, but when they rekindled their relationship in Toronto that summer, they started to become romantically involved. So a month or so later, she visits him on the set of Two Lane Blacktop that he was filming at the time. And they start writing together and had, quote, some of the most outrageous good times.
Well, I wouldn't put it past James Taylor, honestly. That's impressive.
Not one bit.
Read into outrageous good times what you will. It's pretty much widely accepted that these good times are what inspired the song The Flight Tonight. So by October, they're spending all their time together. They're sharing a stage at London's Paris Theatre. They recorded for BBC Radio 1 in this like live concert series that they did. And this is where she starts to unveil all these new songs that she's been writing during her European retreat and her writing sessions with James Taylor. She eventually returns to London at the end of November, where she kind of rolls out the beta of this album. And immediately everyone's like, holy shit, this is the best album that Joni Mitchell has ever written. And it's not even out yet. Unanimous praise, unanimous applause. Before this album even comes out, she's voted 1970s top female performer.
Damn.
Just based off the live shows of this album that's not out yet.
That's crazy.
Cool. Yeah. Joni Mitchell was it in 1970.
Yeah.
So by early 71, she and James Taylor are like the golden couple. They're the Brad and Angelina of 1970. They're both young, they're both hot, they're both free-spirited, they're living that California Laurel Canyon lifestyle, and they're both getting ready to release solo albums. She's singing backup vocals on his album. He is not singing backup vocals on her album. Read into that as you will. But he does add guitar to California, All I Want, and A Case of You.
Cool.
Together, they accepted an invitation from Carol King to work on a reworked version of Will You Love Me Tomorrow for Tapestry, because they were recording at the same studio that she was recording that at. Fun fact.
Mm-hmm.
Shockingly, this relationship did not last, as many Hollywood relationships don't. And this breaks Joni's heart. Like, she was madly in love with him. She was having the time of her life doing artistic things with James Taylor. And so she continues writing for Blue and writes like some really rough breakup songs, specifically Blue, the title track. Blue and All I Want are very obviously about James Taylor. They have super specific relationship references, such as a sweater that she knitted for him and his heroin addiction.
Whoa.
That will do it. That will cause a breakup.
That'll get you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't do drugs, kids. Even though they had like a rocky relationship, she and James Taylor were like very, very bonded. And so obviously she was very emotional. That's what I just had in my previous bullet point. Sorry, that is repetitive. So she releases this album and she later tells Rolling Stone about it, that it felt like she had no personal defenses because she was so raw and so vulnerable and emotional. She felt like she was rocking around in a cellophane wrapper that's on the pack of cigarettes. She had absolutely no secrets in the world, couldn't pretend to be strong or to be happy, and so the advantage of it in the music is that there were no defenses from that either. She says there's hardly a dishonest note in the vocals. When this album dropped, people were shocked because people weren't writing, you know, Taylor Swift level breakup songs yet. They were like happy or super, super surface level. And she's just like, this man ripped my heart out and stomped it on the floor. And I'm going to be upset about it, whether you want me to be upset or not. And critics didn't really know what to do with it, because not only is it new territory, but it's a woman in new territory, and they didn't really like it. Shocker. Yeah.
I wonder why.
Yeah, surprise.
So jumping ahead to like the critical acclaim, cultural impact of the album, it is probably the shortest album that we've covered so far in this series. It's only 36 minutes, 10 songs, but they hit. Like, I know that it had to be curated to fit onto a one LP at the time. So that is part of the reason why it's so short. But you can fit up to 44 minutes on a one disc. So
yeah,
she knew what she was doing when she called it down. I like it. I like a good short album every now and then. I wrote in my notes that this is the grandmother of Taylor Swift.
that's good. And the godmother's Dolly Parton.
Yes.
Oh, nice.
And Carole King's in there somewhere too, because she was the one that got chosen to honor.
She's the aunt that comes in from New York.
Yes. She's the vodka aunt.
Yeah, the vodka. The vodka aunt, 100%.
This is considered the quintessential confessional singer-songwriter album. Probably one of the first. I don't have anything to back that up. I'm just going to venture and say that it was probably the first. One of the first to show songs with raw nerves, tales of love and loss in stunning complexity. Most of the album is just her and a guitar. Like, she used some weird tunings to kind of get the sound that she wanted, because she, you know, had a love affair with the Appalachian dulcimer while she was in Europe. But I think it makes it that much more heartbreaking and that much more vulnerable, because she's not hiding behind any other instrumentation.
She went a long way. Hold on a sec. So it's called the Appalachian dulcimer that she found
in
Europe.
I don't know why it was in Crete.
Why did she really go that long of a way when she could have just went to Tennessee? Got the same effect.
It was some dude she met in Crete, just had one. So I'm gonna go on a limb and guess that he was American too.
Yeah,
just a guess.
Appalachian dulcimer, you know, they're not making those in Italy. I'll tell you that right now.
So to wrap up, do I think it deserves number? What number is it?
Three.
It is number three. Do I think it deserves number three? No, I think it deserves number two because it is better than Pet Sounds, in my opinion. I don't like Pet Sounds. Sorry, Beach Boys. I think that because Marvin Gaye is number one, I think she should be number two. Because Pet Sounds, while sonically, like, no one else was doing that at the time, it was a big, ambitious project. I'm a lyrics person, and Pet Sounds lyrics are just not that great. There's a place that I wish I could go alone in my room, in my room, in my room, in my room. So
poetry.
Joni has them beat
Shakespeare,
lyrically.
Whoever writes for the Rolling Stones.
Oh, and then one other fact is you cannot listen to this album on Spotify right now because Joni has pulled like 80% of her music because she's protesting Joe Rogan, which I just... We stand Joni's decision.
Well, we're here for this.
We support.
So you guys listened to the album. What's your favorite song off of the album? As my cat attacks my computer.
Beth Ann, I want you to go first because I want to see
That's
how this is
totally
done.
Fine.
I want to know.
I'm a title track person through and through. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, and I will be honest, gave him very quick skims because... Like we were talking before it, I came back from a conference and then took a 2-hour nap within 30 minutes of being home. So, but with that said, I mean, it's a great opener for sure. And so, yeah, I'm going to say that title track. I can't think of the name of it right now. And I'm trying to.
Blue.
Is that what it
is? That's the
that
title
would,
track.
That would be a title track.
Like I said. Very tired. Came from a big conference. That's what I would say.
That's a good one. I think for me, so like this is as someone like who's not as into music and like I have like very specific music that like I just gravitate towards and I don't really get outside of my realm. I've never listened to Joni Mitchell before. This is the first time. I think
it's okay. I hadn't either before we did this podcast.
Oh, yeah. I love it. Okay, perfect. So I think definitely her vibe, like now that you explain all that, I'm like, oh, she was an icon. Like this is a huge album of the time. And you know, I had no clue. I think for me, I like My Old Man the most. At least like upon my like re-listen that I was going through. Because she has this one line on there, it says, "You're my sunshine in the morning and fireworks at the end of the day." And I was like, that's pretty good. I like that. And
I do like that one.
She can hit some high notes. I was pretty impressed. Can. I was like, dang, she's got pipes. Like it's really crazy. But I would pick that.
That's a good choice. She also has a really impressive musicality, like how she decides to build her notes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've always enjoyed that with her.
Personally, my favorite, I think, is All I Want. I think. Great breakup song. I'm a fan. I don't like sad music, but I do like a good breakup song.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like when I was listening to this, I was like, man, this would be the perfect album to listen to after, like, you know, your long distance partner like comes in and stays with you for a week and you have like a wonderful week together and then you drop them back off at the airport and you have to go back to your home alone.
Yes.
And you put this album on and you just like cry your heart out and you're just like,
yes.
I'm the saddest person in the universe. And I was like, this is it. Yeah. So if I'm ever in that situation, I got my album.
I have been in that situation. And let me tell you, I almost got into two car wrecks. It was great.
Oh my gosh. See? Put on Joni Mitchell. She'll get you right. She'll get you vocal.
Yeah, you got to get home before you start crying.
Oh, that's funny.
And then to wrap up Joni Mitchell, we always compare where the album was on the 2012 list versus where it is on the 2020 list. And it was number 30 on the 2012 list. So I feel like they justified moving her way up. Like 30 to 3 is a big jump.
Good
and
deal.
That's
a big jump.
Is not a good segue, but we're going to segue into The Clash's London Calling, which is number 16.
May I just start by saying this? So the Clash, I've covered them before. Do not be surprised. I am once again covering an album I already talked about. It's called I'm Tired and Lazy, and I already did the research, so I'm going to take that cheap opportunity. But with that said, this was my least popular episode. And it was partly because... Oh, no, it's fine. It's because I had some hot takes that the Clash fan groups did not find amusing, even though I was right. So that's okay. That's all right. So,
well, it's not our fault they had Nazi tendencies. Yeah, it's career.
Couldn't
listen,
determine that.
If you name something after the SSS, I am rightly going to roast you. There is no other way to do that. I don't care how anarchist you thought you were being. So for those listening and you're wondering, oh, she's finally going to recant. One, I'm not. Number two, my opinions have remained the same. So sorry. But anyway, not to get that out of the way. So London Calling is the Clash's third album. Something about punk bands, Thorough Lines, this band was very much like for that. They were one of the first punk bands on the scene in London, along with the Sex Pistols. They were coming up with them. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely this kind of like legacy aspect to it. As far as for them performing, they didn't really like to practice as much, except when it came to an album. So like with like three chords and I guess a weed dealer in every corner, like I could see how that'd be the case. But anyway, so when they get into an album mode though, these guys go hard. How hard? Well, they do 18-hour recording days.
Woof.
Yes.
How?
Yes.
There's more than weed involved in that.
You got to upgrade for that kind of longevity.
Yeah, we're talking about Mr. White Powder himself.
Yeah.
But so they're doing 16-hour recording days. I'm sorry, 18-hour recording days. And they're starting to change their sound. So, which I think is interesting because punk had only been around for like 2 years up to that point. So they're already starting to like, oh, let's see how we can shift it. It's very much like grunge. Like the first British punk movement kind of burned hot and fast. And then it went ahead and just started breaking into subgenres and whatnot. And this is, I would say, the first example we see of that. So instead of going that pure punk sound, hi, Rhodey. Thanks for coming to join our episode. They're incorporating elements of rockabilly, reggae, rhythm and blues. So they're kind of pulling all different influences, which is cool. And this is also for this band, one of those make or break moments, because up to this point, I mean, they have some small success, some indie success, especially in the Camden area of London. But Joe Strummer, the lead singer, guitarist and main songwriter, is having this really big writer's block that's like over a year, which terrifies me as someone who works in marketing, does content writing. They parted with their manager. They don't have really money, which may be related to the drugs, may or may not.
Maybe.
So when they were getting ready to record, they hired this dude. His name's Guy Stevens, and he is the J.K. Simmons from Whiplash of the punk world.
Love to meaning, see it.
Meaning he legitimately threw a chair at them. Like the exact scene in Whiplash. You know it. You know it, Ethan. Hi, Rhodey.
Yeah. Banger scene. Banger movie.
That's one of my favorite movies of all time. But anyway, so he throws chairs at them. He throws a ladder at the wall. He pours red wine on a piano while Joe Strummer's playing it. I don't understand his methods, but it works for the band to work harder. So I guess he knows something I don't know about pushing people to make
whatever
good music.
It takes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, so for a little punk band with no money, the album has sold over 5 million copies. It was number one on Rolling Stone's 100 best albums of the 80s. And at the time, like, critics and fans loved it. And in hindsight, it is considered the first post-punk album, which goes back to like they have you know, started like 3 years before. It was pub rock, then it turned to punk, and then shortly after, now it's post-punk. London Calling is a double album, which was sold as a single album, which if they don't have money and they have a double album thing, why are they selling a single? Anyway, just a rant.
Gotta get a new marketing campaign manager. Get it figured out.
Yeah. But then again, it's very punk of them to do that because
so punk.
They were screwing over the record label in their minds.
Literally. Like, since hardcore scene is very similar, comes out of the punk, I know, like, at the hardcore scene, there would be people selling their albums for, like, $2, and then you could buy a shirt for, like, $5. So I kind of get it why they did it, because that kind of stems for that. But anyway, still, luckily they sold 5 million albums, so I guess worked down the end. They covered topics such as drugs, racial injustice and police brutality, nuclear war, and safe sex.
At least they're having safe sex.
They're looking out.
Least,
yeah.
At least, you know, mind the drugs. You know, at least they're doing their due diligence and not getting anyone pregnant. You know, you can respect that. We respect that. The iconic album cover is a combination of two things. Elvis Presley and smashing of instruments. The photo was taken after a moment of frustration when bassist Paul Simonon. It even messed me up in the episode when we recorded it. He smashed his bass on stage at a show once because the bouncers wouldn't let people stand up and have like a fucking concert. So like he was mad because no one was moshing. And I get that. I completely understand that frustration. The pink and green lettering is an homage to Elvis Presley's self-titled album, which I think was his first album.
It is his first.
It's first album. Okay, cool. So as far as for, does it deserve to be as high on the Rolling Stone list? So I think it was, let me go back here.
It was eight.
It was eight. That's what I thought. It was eight, and then it dropped down some. I think for where it is now, number 16, it's tricky for me because I am actually like, we cover a lot of artists that, necessarily like me and Leah, do we like them? No, we just like the stories. That's, you know, so like the Clash, that style of punk is just not my favorite. So personally, would I put it that high? No, but I do have to say historically, it makes sense why the band is there, because they took punk and broke it out, because that post-punk, you know, we've covered this a lot on the podcast, a lot of genres came out of that one movement, and this is the beginning of that branching off. And also just a fun tidbit that kind of explains why they are where they are. After this album was released, they went from just another punk band to being called the only band that matters, and they were introduced on stage as that. So it's fair to say historically it had a big impact. So historically I would say yes. Personally, in my taste, not really, but that's okay. But let's go into favorite songs. Which ones did you guys like?
I mean, for me, obviously London Calling's a banger, but I feel like that's a pretty easy answer.
I'm saying that, so you know.
Okay, all right.
We're in the same boat. We're in the same boat.
That's fair.
Looking at the Spotify numbers, that tracks.
Title tracks,
London
let's
Calling
go.
Has 258 million streams. All the rest have barely 20 million. So
yeah,
it's like 2,000% more.
It's absolutely insane that that's the first track on the album too. Mm-hmm. Like that, the I don't know how rare it is, or I don't know if you guys know like how rare it is for like a first track to be like the single most popular one on the album. I think that's very interesting.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I really liked Hateful, and I also really like Lover's Rock, and I feel like Lover's Rock like does not have a lot of plays, but I was like, dang. If I knew this song, like if I knew it better, and if like this was my band, I like listened to them, this would be the song that I would like to like turn on and just like karaoke to. I feel like it's really singable, got a great melody. I like those songs quite a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Leah?
I'm going to say my least favorite song, because Lost in the Supermarket is the song I hate most in this world. I don't know what it is about
it. Whoa, hot take.
But something about it just stresses me out and makes me angry, and I cannot sit there and listen to it.
Well,
I have a vendetta against that song for no real reason.
Let me look at my notes. I wrote, as far as for favorite songs, I only really like London Calling and Lost in a Supermarket. So
I hate that song.
A lot has just been explained about how Lee and I work for. but yeah, London Calling, I mean, out of those two, Lost in a Supermarket, I like because I like the musical style of it. Because then that's where you start hearing like the different styles throughout. And I enjoy that. But London Calling is just like has such a good like swing to it. Dun, 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 dun.
It's iconic.
Yeah, it's a great iconic swing. But yeah, those are the two for me. So as far as for, yeah, The Clash, just to kind of end it on a note of some sort. They're a band. This is a very famous album cover. And yeah.
They might really be Nazis. We don't know.
But, love that. Post 2-hour nap and post COVID. That's all I really got to say about it.
That comes to mind.
Yes. They are a band.
And that is all they need.
They're the only band that matters. So yeah, that's all you need to know, right?
Hey, Bubby.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. Well, I'll do my beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. This is definitely the most current album, like out of this list of albums here.
Oh, yeah.
By like 40 years. So we're really jumping styles here. Bethann, you mentioned album covers again. This album specifically, so you know, albums by Kanye West, highly regarded. I'll go into a little bit of detail, but highly regarded as like his best album of all time, if not the greatest rap album of all time.
Yeah.
And speaking of the album cover, like this album cover, it was banned in different countries. There's an alternate album cover. The standard one is pixelated because of like the art that is depicted. And that was like, that was Kanye's goal, was to like create a statement with this. So when you talk about, you know, like iconic album covers, this is definitely up there. I think in terms of like some of the most iconic. So this came out in November of 2010. And this is his fifth studio album, directly follows 808s and Heartbreaks, which, you know, if you listen to that, you know, exceptionally different from this album. That was his auto-tune phase. That was his different kind of phase of experimenting with things. Not great critical reception for that.
Mm-hmm.
But this album's interesting because, so it takes place after the Taylor Swift incident that happens at the Grammys, or at the MTV Music Awards. And, happens after that, and yeah, wild stuff. And basically said, he basically goes into like a self-induced, like kind of goes away from like a self-imposed exile, really, and like goes to Hawaii and records this album. And I guess he book blocks three session rooms in this recording studio in Hawaii simultaneously for 24 hours a day and works on this album. He when he gets like stuck working on one song, he just jumps to the next studio and works on the next song. He didn't sleep at night. He just took 90-minute naps during the day for 3 days straight, like cranking out this album, which, you know, in like classic Kanye fashion, that's like what you would expect for something like this, you know, coming from like kind of the genius side of things. Has iconic songs. All of the Lights is regarded as like one of the best songs that Kanye has ever put out. And then looking at, I wanted to mention the kind of like, so the album ranking, I'm not jumping yet to the end of my thing. I have more to say, but I do think it's important to note Billboard number one spot for the top 10 albums of 2010, number one spot for the 25 best albums of 2010, number one spot for the 100 best albums of 2010, obviously. Rolling Stone put it at number one album for the best album of 2010. Number one in tons of other lists for albums of 2010s and greatest like rap album of all time, which I think is interesting. And then I think this album in particular is really fascinating for Kanye as an artist because he basically takes this opportunity to talk about every album that's preceded it, right? College Dropout, and Graduation and everything, about how he wanted to come out of Chicago and have a life full of stardom and fame and everything like that. And this My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is literally that, right? Like his fantasy is that he becomes the single power, the single person in the music industry. And in this album, he tells the story of how he achieves that, but it really deteriorates him, like, as a person. And by the end of the album, you get to some really, really dark songs about, like, his sex addiction and his drug addiction and, like, really terrible things. Does that translate in a lot of the songs? It kind of depends. A lot of, like, there's a Chris Rock monologue that's just, like, really bad in one of these songs. But there's also other songs that, you know, really touch on that quite well. So I think it's a very interesting storytelling. I do think that this album is probably one of Kanye's best, like, lyrically stylized albums. I think it's got one of the most important, his best ability to do that lyricism and talk about, like, race in America. And, I mean, that's the last album on the track, right? Mm-hmm. Who Will Survive in America is kind of like the motif of the album, which I think is interesting. But yeah, this album is very interesting. It has a very interesting history that goes along with it. And I do think it is fascinating coming off of 808s and Heartbreaks and that he decides to change so drastically. And then after this, he goes on to make Yeezus, which again, like, in this three album period, exceptionally different forms of art, all coming from the same person. And this was kind of this, like, time of his life was very compact into, like, this album, I feel like, this kind of rise to his fame. But yeah, I think it's had massive cultural impact, as we all know. I think Kanye, not only himself, has massive cultural impact, and you know, whatever's happening right now with Kanye, I'm a little bit removed, and I think it's a little bit, kind of, sad / ridiculous / too crazy kind of a thing. But he's a musical genius at his heart, at his core, and everybody knows that, and this album kind of displays that quite well. I think, does it deserve number 17? I think it does. I don't know. That's a kind of a tough question, because, like, it's To Pimp a Butterfly is sitting at 19. This is sitting at 17. Mm-hmm. You've got, like, Thriller at 12, which is obvious. Like, that needs to be up there. Rumors at 7. Like, that needs to be up there. But, you know, I do think it is the most influential album of the 2010s, if not, like, the most influential rap album of all time. There are highs and lows. There are a lot of things I like and a lot of things I don't like. So I'm curious for favorite songs, because this is very different from what you all talked about in your music. I'm curious, like, how you thought of this album.
I'll go first.
Sorry, Rody is being very distracting. And I
figured
apologize.
It was a Rody problem.
Yeah, he's currently making his spot for the night, so apologies.
Getting ready.
Yeah.
So as a diehard Swiftie, I could not let this go in my Spotify Wrapped for the year, so I had to listen to it on Amazon Music so that it would not affect my data.
Wow, impressive.
That's the kind of person I am.
That's commitment.
But
that's a whole other tier of fandom that I don't even understand, Leah.
That's impressive.
My dedication to Taylor Swift. This album dropped the fall of my senior year of high school. And I just remember hearing it everywhere, and everyone was obsessed with this. I was a Taylor Swift fan, so I wasn't listening to it, but also I'm not an R&B rap person to begin with, so like, I wasn't going out and seeking this album in 2010. But I've listened to it twice this year because I've been trying to work through the albums and then revisiting it for this. And like, I like it more than I want to admit that I like it, because it is a really good album. And for someone who doesn't gravitate towards that kind of music, I bop with it. Like, it is nice. It is good. My favorite has to be Power, just because it sounds like 2010, and every time I listen to it, I am just transported back to senior year of high school because it was playing everywhere at the time. Mm-hmm. It's also a great pump up song at the gym.
It is. Yeah, so Kanye, you know, I actually do like Kanye a lot. I think you know, not to do a whole analysis of his life, but how can you not when he's one of the most polarizing figures right. in music? You know, for someone who, you know, we could talk before he becomes Donda $45 vegan popcorn
with his MP3 player that you can only
with Marilyn Manson.
Yeah. Geez.
Being there, you know, anyway, before all that, you know, I think Kanye, why it's so hard as fans to see what's happening is because we know he's one of the best rappers in the game. Mm-hmm. Like, since Through the Wire, since he was producing, he originally was just a producer, and then Through the Wire was written out of him like having his mouth wired shut. It just propelled him into, like, he was able to actually finally show what he's made of. And I mean, this album is a really good example. I think the 2010s, I mean, The Graduate, is that what it is, with the one with the bear on it?
Graduation.
Thank you. That's a good album. But I think, like, this album, into Yeezus, into, it's the one that has that 900 Romans song, and I can't even think of it. Whatever album that is. This is like
Pablo.
You're talking Watch the Throne?
Watch the Throne. With Jay-Z. That's what I'm talking about. No, Life of Pablo, like, you were talking about the artwork. Oh, it's great. It's a great album. I love that album. But if we're talking about artwork, this is a peak, and then it slowly just starts
to degrade.
The bro literally, for his singles, just starts taking screenshots of his text messages. Like,
look, Kids See Ghost album artwork, though? Come on. That's fire stuff.
I understand. But the Pablo was made on a 98 Microsoft Paint, and he felt no shame or remorse over it. I'm just saying, the album, one of my favorite albums. The artwork, not my biggest fan. But anyway, so this is, I feel like, the launch of that golden era of Kanye. And so, yeah, Power is probably my favorite song. Runaway is also up there. I think it also speaks to the longevity of the album, because, like I said, 2010, even though it doesn't feel that far away from me, was 12 years ago. And we're seeing a resurgence of it, because Runaway, I've heard on TikTok before. All the Lights, I've heard on TikTok before. Power, obviously. So, like, you're still hearing it sampled, and I mean sampled in more of a TikTok way. Like, you're still hearing it in mm-hmm. pieces throughout. So it speaks to the longevity of it. But yeah, this is obviously a good album. This is not my favorite Kanye album. It honestly might be Life of Pablo, if I'm honest. Mm-hmm. Especially because that opening track, you get Kirk Franklin in there, which plays to my old, you know, days when I was in the church, but it's still good stuff. So anyway, that's I think this is a good album. I think, should it place where it is? Honestly, it's hard, because To Pimp a Butterfly may be just also one of my favorite mm-hmm. albums. And so I would probably
know where it was before you guys make a decision of,
yeah,
if it deserves a spot.
Yeah.
In 2012, it was at 353.
Woof. That's underrated. So I mean,
they
come
bumped
on.
It up.
That so is not
they
correct.
Bumped it up 330 something spots, though. That's
yes.
bananas. Mm.
So if that influences the ultimate,
well,
that
shows longevity.
Fascinating.
But
yeah.
To Pimp a Butterfly is at 19. So, like, I feel like I would just put that a little higher for me, because I think that album is, like, world-changing. Like, Kanye is a world-changing artist. There's actually no doubt about it. But Kendrick is the succession of that.
Yep.
Like, Kanye, mm-hmm. it's a Kanye Rand situation for a Kendrick to walk. You know mm. what I mean?
You got
and
that
I just,
backwards, but yes.
Walk to run.
Walk to run, run to walk, whatever the fuck.
Fair.
Whatever. My brain is still figuring itself out after COVID and a 2-hour nap. But yeah, that's my thoughts on Kanye. And this album. I think it's, no matter what, a great album. It's that launching of the golden era of Kanye for me.
Yeah, I think there's a couple more things I wanted to quickly mention. So, like, it's reported that Kanye spent over $3 million making this album, which I think is,
good God.
Just absolutely fascinating. And you know, however he went about that is how he did it. And I think one of the most interesting marketing aspects of this is that this was, so right before this album released, Kanye initiated a free music program called Good Fridays to kind of like reinvigorate mm-hmm. like New Music Fridays. And so he would every single Friday offer a free download of an unreleased song, some of which were included in this album. So you talk about like Power and Runaway and things like that and All of the Lights, like people got these for free like months before the album came out. And apparently critics and like the market was pretty PO'd at Kanye because he was just like giving out free music through his brand. And, you know, which obviously, you know, now as well, like he has STEM, he has his own thing. But I think it's very interesting that he kind of went about it that way. I think for me, like listening to this album, I am really intrigued with Dark Fantasy. And I know Nicki Minaj has a rough accent, a very rough, like fake British accent in this song. But besides that, like, I think Dark Fantasy has some of his best lyrics that he's ever put like in anything. The plan was to drink until the pain over, but what's worse, the pain or the hangover? Like, it's so simple, but it's so complex. And it's so intriguing about how Kanye thinks about things. And you get two really big tonal shifts in that song, which I think is really, really fun. I would say Dark Fantasy is my favorite. Runaway is a very close second. And everybody knows like that iconic. I remember going to the Life of Pablo concert, whatever, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago now. And, you know, those were the concerts where he just had the floating stage. And that was like him and that's it, right? And I go to see him and we're partway through the concert, whatever. And he just plays the one note for Runaway and the crowd just loses their shit. Like literally all it takes is that one note. And I think that proves in and of itself, like whether you like the song or not, that is iconic. Like that is a master at his craft. One note. And that's all you need to know about this one song. Mm-hmm. I think it's really good, but I do think the album gets progressively worse. Like, I think Blame Game has some really lazy lyrics. I think it's really not great. And then you get some really weird things that he just chooses to do. But, you know, that's his creative nature, I guess. But, yeah, he's going to get some good stuff on there. I think it's a really iconic album.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I agree. Anyone have any closing thoughts? Because we've covered our three albums.
Love it. I mean,
three very different
solid
albums.
Solid picks. One of these days, we'll choose Marvin Gaye at number one.
He's got to stay there. He's been there for four episodes now.
For the record, I do love that album, but there's just been other albums that I'm like, oh, I want to talk about this first. So we will eventually. No hate to my Marvin Gaye fans. We will get to that album because it is a very important album and a good album.
Next volume, it might happen because next volume's a little slim pickings.
Mm. Oh boy!
But yeah,
I appreciate you guys having me on to talk about this. This is exciting. I did try to probably last year, like deep in COVID, I was like, cool, Rolling Stones has 500 albums. I'm gonna try to listen to them, and I got like 30 albums in, and then I was like, man, this is really taxing because I just like the music that I like.
I did the same thing.
It was tough. It was hard. I did get to some that I really liked, but then there were like the things, you know, Joni Mitchell, iconic, like great. But then there were things like that where I was just like, this is definitely not my music. And I don't want to skip it because I need to listen to it, but I really don't. I'd rather just listen to, you know, 21 Pilots again. So
I understand.
I got to Radiohead and I was like, oh, I don't know how madly I want to do this.
Wow, impressive. Oh, man. Yeah, there's lots of good ones on this list. That's exciting.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ethan, so much for being on.
Thank you.
This will not be your only time on. We will have you another time, I'm sure. And Ethan and I also recently did a auction draft where we both got screwed, may I just say.
Yeah, we did. The whole thing was a sham. It was rigged.
I do have to say, unfortunately, because you were at the top, they came for you hard, my friend.
It was brutal. It was tough.
So hard.
I had won the first auction that we did on three films and a pod, and I was feeling really good. And then Beth Ann included, everybody just came for me and they undercut me. They went for my legs, they went for the knees, they went for the chest, and they just took me down.
Out of everyone in that group,
listen,
I have the right. I have the exclusive rights to campaign against you because we were off by one vote.
That's fair. You one do. Vote. Nobody else
the
does,
others
though.
Do not. Do okay. not. I stake the claim. The rivalry is between me and you. So that's, others that's trying fair. To get in on it. This is a no. me and you situation.
This is me and you. Leah, can I ask you one question? I just want to know something, okay?
Oh, shit.
Okay.
Listen, we're talking about best movie franchises of all time, okay? Best movie franchises of all time. Mission Impossible. The Mission Impossible movie franchise. Pretty good, right? Oh, this is no good. Okay, I'm not going to get the answer I want.
Keep going, Ethan. No, keep going.
Where are you going with this?
I bid on this franchise. I own this franchise in the draft, but I have only seen one of the movies. Does that matter? Okay. Do I need to see all the movies in a franchise to claim that it's great?
Well, if you're going to claim it's great,
it's great, yes, because Mission Impossible is arguably not a great franchise.
Wow. Leah, hot take. Holy cow.
Sorry.
I mean,
okay. Someone that's, has been forced to watch many Mission Impossible movies.
Okay.
They're okay.
Okay. All right.
I mean, the idea that, listen. Like, to claim something is great, that's like going into a random store and like buying sunglasses and saying, this is the best store I've ever been in my entire life. Look at this $3 sunglasses I just bought.
What about Harry Potter? Saying. Harry Potter, pretty great.
Pretty great. Have you seen anything in it?
Seen them all.
Then you can claim that one.
Then I can have it. Okay, great. Awesome.
Yeah, you can have Harry Potter.
Good. I thought that was going to take me to the final. Apparently the fans didn't agree. I don't know. We got to figure that out.
Star Wars won.
Thomas was a juggernaut of a ticket. And I know Ethan campaigned hard. I pulled all the marketing stops out. And I still could not beat this juggernaut of a draft. Anyway, thanks for being on the show.
Yes.
Thank you.
I know you have a concert to get to. Enjoy 21 Pilots.
You're good. Yeah, thank you. I'm very excited. It just so happens I recorded with you a music pod the same day I'm going to my first concert in like 2 years. I'm very excited.
Thank you for listening. You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts if you like this show. Special thanks to Death of Fawn for our intro riff. You can visit our website at shewillrockyou.com. There you'll find links to our social, the show notes, and a place where you can contact us. Other than that, don't do drugs.